From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, Donald Trump answered the question he's been asked since January. What happened to the $6 million he said he raised for veterans in that fundraiser in Iowa? At a wild press conference in which he called an ABC reporter sleazy and blamed the press for making him name names, he finally read out some of the organizations.
Armed Services, YMCA of the United States, $75,000. Bob Woodruff Family Foundation, Inc., they do a good job, $75,000. Central Iowa Shelter and Services, these are all vet-related, $100,000.
NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, was listening in. Domenico, some veterans groups were also asking about the money. It wasn't just the press. What do you make of the press conference in which he really seemed more interested in attacking the press than listing the organizations?
Well, he certainly listed the organizations. He listed all of them when he could have just put them out in a press release, which he did as well. But it seemed overly defensive, frankly. I mean, if this is talking about raising millions of dollars for various charities, you know, he was very upset with the press, called them dishonest and the like. And I think it really has more to do with the fact that what the press is looking at are a discrepancy in numbers. So we tend to ask questions when he says they raised $6 million and then his campaign manager said that it was only $4.5 million and he said he donated $1 million and the press is asking for proof and he got annoyed with that.
Well, and especially when someone asked them, don't you think you're running for president? And it makes you wonder. By the way, he also said it's very difficult. It was very difficult to vet many of these organizations. But it makes you wonder if he purposely withheld this information to set up the media. Media critic Dan Kennedy tweeted out, "You scrutinize Trump, which means you hate the veterans and America." Let's listen to one of the responses of Donald Trump that, you know, Dan Kennedy might have said sounded like that.
The press should be ashamed of themselves. And on behalf of the vets, the press should be ashamed of themselves. They are calling me and they are furious.
He also called out ABC reporter Tom Yamas. Let's just listen.
What I don't want is when I raise millions of dollars, have people say, like this sleazy guy right over here from ABC. He's a sleaze in my book. You're a sleaze because you know the facts and you know the facts well. Go ahead.
Do you think he seemed to lose a little of his cool?
Well, this is par for the course for Trump. I mean, he's gotten into a habit of calling the press disgusting. He's said that they're dishonest several times. The real thing that struck me is that he decided to say when it came to Susana Martinez, who's the governor of New Mexico, and asking about unity with the Republican Party, he says, I'm not going to change. She wasn't nice to me, so
he
I'm not going to change.
Her. Yeah, he attacked
right.
her last week.
So the idea of saying that he's not going to change is interesting considering that he seems to be back in mid-primary form rather than pivoting to a general election, which he really does need to do.
At one point, Martinez was thought of as a rising star in the party and possible VP, and he did go after her. He was also asked today about Judge Gonzalo Curiel, who ruled against Donald Trump last week, saying that documents have to be released in the lawsuits against Trump University. Donald Trump blasted the judge then, made an insinuating comment, something like, we hear he's Mexican, when the judge was actually born in the U.S. But where are we on those lawsuits?
Well, the judge said on Friday he ruled that the documents relating to Trump University lawsuit had to be unsealed. Trump is accused of misleading thousands of people who paid some $35,000-$36,000 for these seminars about investment strategies that people didn't seem to get much more than a piece of paper for. And the judge ordered them be released. Well, Trump called him a hater, called him very hostile. He did bring up his Mexican ancestry, even though he was born in Indiana, graduated from Indiana Law School. And one ethics expert who happened to be from the University of Indiana or Indiana University said that that Trump could be sanctioned for indirect criminal contempt of court, interestingly. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. But this is par for the course for Trump. If there's somebody says something he doesn't like, he goes after them and punches down.
Yeah. Well, go to the Democratic side of things. California Governor Jerry Brown endorsed Hillary Clinton in an open letter out this morning. He said Clinton has the tenacity and skill to advance the Democratic agenda. Clinton is reportedly heading back to California because next Tuesday's primary is now so close with Bernie Sanders. And this weekend on Meet the Press, Chuck Dodd asked Sanders about whether he'd take that phone call from Hillary Clinton if she were to offer him a spot on the ticket. Here's his response.
Right now, again, what I am here we are in California. I'm knocking my brains out to win the Democratic nomination. That's where That's where I am right now. What happens afterwards, we will, you know, we'll see.
Whoa, that wasn't a no.
I wouldn't wait by the phone if I were Bernie Sanders, if he's looking for the phone call to be Hillary Clinton's vice president. That's probably not going to happen. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, mathematically almost impossible for Bernie Sanders to win this race. But California is critically important. The polls have gotten very close there. In fact, Bernie Sanders taken a lead in a couple of them, or at least been within a couple points. So California, again, if Hillary Clinton can't put away Bernie Sanders one more time, even though the math is on her side and will be on her side, you know, it shows tremendous vulnerability. Yeah. On Jerry Brown endorsing Hillary Clinton, it's really interesting to me, given they've long had a frosty relationship, Jerry Brown and the Clintons. 1992, in a debate there, Brown actually accused Bill Clinton of funneling money to his wife's law firm. Mm. Clinton denied that charge, but Bill said that that Brown didn't even deserve to stand on the same platform as his wife. Apparently no longer has this kind of animosity. But it's interesting because Brown has turned from an ideologue to much more of a technocrat as he's governed. Yeah. So very interesting to see this change.
That sometimes happens when you actually have the job. Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thank you.
At least 1,000 people have drowned or are believed to have drowned trying to make their way across the Mediterranean Sea from Libya to Italy, according to estimates from the International Organization for Migration. The actual number could well be higher, and many of those who died have been crammed onto three different boats that capsized and sank just in the past week. The UN Refugee Agency says it was the deadliest week on the Mediterranean Sea since April 2015, when more than 1,300 people died. Ruby Hartbrich is with Sea-Watch, a German NGO that operates a search and rescue ship in the Mediterranean. That ship was there Friday when one of the migrant boats capsized, and they assisted the Italian Navy with search and rescue. We reached Ruby today via Skype at Sea-Watch's busy and very active and noisy base camp in Malta, and she told us that when the team arrived on the scene, they first pulled survivors to safety, but that there were already many corpses floating in the water.
So we tried to mark the dead bodies with life vests. We just put life vests on them so they were not sinking, because corpses, they tend to sink very quickly in salt water. So afterwards, the Italian Navy picked up the dead bodies that we marked before.
Well, it was on this mission that one of your volunteers did pull a baby from the water, who then I believe he realized the baby was dead, and Sea-Watch released a photo of this. It's so hard to look at, of the volunteer cradling the dead child. And, of course, it reminds us all of that picture of Alan Kurdi, the 3-year-old Syrian boy who washed up on a Turkish beach a while ago. I mean, why did you decide to release that photograph?
We received the picture in the evening of this mission. We thought a while if to publish or not. But then we decided to release it because it's like a very strong picture, and it symbolizes really what is happening there. And it's a humanitarian catastrophe happening in the Mediterranean Sea. For years now, there are many people drowning, and this picture we see really is the product of our foreign policy.
Are you noticing now a significant rise in the number of people trying to make this crossing from Libya to Italy because the route from Turkey to Greece is basically closed?
Yes, we definitely do. The number of migrants waiting in North Africa at the moment is estimated with hundreds of thousands of people. They are waiting for the crossing to Europe, and most of them, they depart in Libya, but there have also been boats detected starting from Egypt this year, which is a new route and even more dangerous and very long. So, and also what we do notice is an increasing number of Arab people on the boats. So the deal between Turkey and EU is finally showing its consequence, and Arab people are now moving towards North Africa to start the passage there.
Hmm. And can you describe to us who are the people making this journey? Where are they from? Tell us more about that. Are you seeing women and children along with men making the trip?
The people are coming from different countries. I mean, obviously they're from war and conflict zones like Central African Republic. They're from Eritrea and also from West Africa, from Mali, just very different countries.
And for those migrants that you're able to rescue and who survive when their ships capsize, what happens to them once they actually make it to Italy?
Well, they are transported to Italy. It depends where exactly in Italy, and then they will first be registered in Europe, and then they can seek for asylum legally. And what happens to them then? We all know that's not a very good situation at the moment. Many of them try to go to countries where they have relatives or friends. They try to cross Europe to Germany or Sweden. So what exactly happens to them, we don't know. We just meet them at sea and send them over to vessels.
Mm. Well, Ruby Hartbrich of Sea-Watch, a German NGO which operates a search and rescue ship in the Mediterranean. Ruby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the millions of fans of Me Before You, the wait is nearly over. The film, based on Jojo Moyes' best-selling book, comes out this week. Arm yourself with tissues. Me Before You tells the story of Louisa Clark, a working-class young Brit in a small town whose waitress gig abruptly ends and her family depends on her for income. She lands a job as caretaker for Will Traynor, a member of the 1% whose high-flying life has been shattered by an accident that leaves him a quadriplegic. She tries to help him. He bitterly resists. It reaches a boiling point.
I'm just trying to do my job as best I can. So it would be really nice if you didn't try and make my life as miserable as you apparently make everyone else's.
And what if I said I didn't want you here?
I'm not employed by you. I'm employed by your mother. So unless she says she doesn't want me here anymore, I'm staying. Not because I care about you or particularly enjoy your company, but because I need the money. I really need the money.
Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones fame as Louisa, Sam Claflin from The Hunger Games as Will, and you may think you know the template. They fall in love. He falls in and out of pneumonia-induced comas. It appears we're heading towards a love story-like ending. He dies from his disability. She's ennobled by their love, but then something really interesting happens. It becomes a story about assisted dying and choice in end of life. Jojo Moyes adapted the book to the screen. She joins us now. Jojo, you many tissues.
That's my favorite thing to hear. I really love making people cry.
Why? Why?
Because if you're that invested in the story, you know, if you've watched that film enough and felt enough to cry, then that means you've really engaged. And that's pretty much the greatest compliment a writer can receive.
Well, a lot of tears shed over the book. A huge bestseller, first in your native Great Britain, then here in the States. Were you surprised by the depth of response to it?
I am surprised daily by the depth of the response. I mean, when I first finished this book, I moved publishers. My career was not going great in publishing terms. And my new publisher said, look, we like this book. We think you'll be able to sell a few copies and we'll kind of start the resurrection of your career with it. And then it went on to sell, I think so far, something like 6 million copies.
Yeah.
It seems to be one of those books that if somebody reads it, they want to tell their friends about it. And in fact, the response to the movie seems to be the same. People are coming out and saying they want to take somebody else to it.
Well, lots of questions because, as we said, it raises some controversial, you step right in a very controversial debate mm-hmm. at the end of it. But talk a little bit about your inspiration, which was real life.
Yeah, well, I'm an ex-journalist and my favorite thing is listening to and reading the news. And I was driving home one day and I heard a story about a young athlete who had been left quadriplegic after an accident and who had persuaded his parents several years later to take him to a center for assisted suicide. And I found this story desperately shocking. Mm. And I couldn't understand how any parent would agree to that. And then I started reading around it and I read about the young man and I read about his parents and I realized that things were not as black and white as I wanted them to be. Mm. You know, as human beings, we like certainty. We like to know what is right and what is wrong. And sometimes in life, you know, there's a lot of gray areas. And more importantly, you can't judge people for the decisions that they make unless you are standing firmly in their shoes.
Well, you've got Will, who's the one who has decided he wants assisted dying. Mm-hmm. He had been a windsurfer, a skier. What could he not do? Also a bit of a jerk. He was, mm-hmm. you know, a corporate raider, it sounds like. And then you've got Louisa, played by Emilia Clarke, who, for our American listeners, her character on screen, it's a little bit like America Ferrera, Ugly Betty. She's of the wildly clashing outfits and, you know, not...
That's a good simile, actually. She's like a British America Ferrera. But she's certainly not an Ugly Betty. She's absolutely beautiful, Amelia.
Well, so was Ugly Betty, as it turns out.
Yeah, that's true.
Here in this scene, she has learned of his decision and she's trying to pull him back to life. And here she suggests a trip to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go. We could get on the Eurostar right now.
Nah.
But you just said...
You don't get it, Clark. I want to be in Paris as me. The old me. With pretty French girls giving me the eye.
Could be something to look forward to.
If I shut my eyes now, I know exactly how it feels to be in that little square. I remember every sensation. I don't want those memories erased by the struggle to fit behind a table. The taxi drivers who refuse to take me and my wheelchair power pack that won't charge in a French socket.
He does not want to go. In fact, he hates his life so much that he has tried to end it. So a question there about the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Do you worry that you're sending out the signal that to have a life of a quadriplegic is not one worth living?
That is absolutely not the message I want this story to have. For me, it's more about two human beings and what do you do if the person you love most makes a decision that you cannot even begin to comprehend. And in the book and in the film, we're very clear to show that there are many people who do not agree with what he wants to do on any grounds. And, you know, it's not, nobody thinks that he's right. It's just that this is a very alpha male who just refuses to lead a life that isn't on the terms that he wants. We all think that if perhaps we suffered a similar accident, we'd like to be like Christopher Reeve, you know, somebody who is full of grace and finds a way through. But sometimes you're going to get someone who just refuses to accommodate that new thing.
And do I understand you've actually heard from the Christopher Reeve Foundation?
I have. In fact, one of the things that I was most happy about was after the book came out, the Christopher Reeve Foundation contacted me via my publishers to say they were really pleased that I showed some of the realities of life for a quadriplegic, you know, the daily struggles, but also that he was a humorous character, a smart character, and more importantly, he's a character that women fall in love with. Mm. You know, the thing that happens here is, and in fact, the thing I really wanted to show is that the disability is the least important thing about somebody. You may see the chair initially, I guarantee you within 20 minutes, you will forget about the chair and you will just be focused on this character. Yeah. And that was what was really important.
And by the way, speaking of things that some people might see as a disability and others mm-hmm. might not, you have a child who's deaf and you've said that you are infuriated when other people have an attitude towards his deafness.
Yeah, I do. We took about 2 weeks to accommodate the fact that our son was profoundly deaf. You know, it was a shock because we had no deafness in the family. And then you get over yourself and you realize that it might not be the life you predicted, but it'll be an entirely wonderful life. It'll just go in a different direction. And I worked out pretty quickly that my son's biggest problem was going to be how other people viewed him rather than any ability or lack of ability that he had. And I still hold that to be the case. Yeah. He is as smart and funny and infuriating and lazy and tricky and, you know, silly as any 11-year-old boy now. And, you know, we don't think of him as a disability. We think of him as a person. So I guess that was feeding into my writing of the book and another reason why I feel passionately that this should not, you know, be seen as some kind of how-to manual.
Yeah. It's also a story about class. In one scene, she's gone with him to a wedding that she would never have gone to and is sitting in his lap. They're dancing at the wedding, and he remarks on their closeness.
You know, you never would have let those breasts so near to me if I was in the wheelchair.
Yeah, well, you never would have been looking at these breasts if you hadn't been in a wheelchair.
Of course I would.
No, you wouldn't. You wouldn't. You would have been too busy looking at the leggy blondes, the ones you can smell an expense account at 40 paces. And anyway, I would have been over there serving the drinks.
One of the invisibles. Am I right?
Jojo Moyes, I want to ask you about a theme from the book, or at least a strand of the book that is not in the movie, which is the implication that Louisa, again, a small town girl who stayed in the small town, had been assaulted, maybe at a party, maybe by a group of guys, maybe by more than one, which would explain, you know, her sort of staying in the town, not thinking as well of herself. Why not put that in the movie?
The problem is, and this was one of the kind of purest examples to me of the difficulties of translating book to film, was that in the book, there is an opaque reference, almost like a throwaway reference to the fact that Louisa may have been assaulted. The reader almost has to go back and go, did she just say what I think she said? And when we tried to translate that into the screenplay, and I worked with the director a long time writing this scene and trying different variations of it, it achieves a different weight when you do that in pictorial form. You cannot do it as a throwaway. The more we tried, the more we realized it just skewed the tone of the whole thing. And, you know, we still worry about that, but you have to make some decisions. You have to lose some things. And all I can say is it was done with a great deal of consideration.
Well, Georgia Moyes, one last thing that the book and film get at, which is so painful. It doesn't matter whether it's end-of-life decisions or somebody, you know, alcoholism or somebody deciding to do something risky you don't agree. It doesn't matter what it is. You really, really can't change someone else.
That's exactly it. You know, people often ask me, what would you do in the same circumstances? And I come back to the same answer every time, which is going to sound a little wishy-washy, but I cannot know because I'm not standing in those shoes. And every decision that you make is going to impact on your family. It's going to impact on the people around you. And, you know, it's in the title. You know, the title means many things, but sometimes people say to me, does it mean I'm putting myself before you? And I suppose in that decision, you can see it that way.
Yeah, Me Before You is the name of the book and the movie. Jojo Moyes wrote both. It opens in theaters this week. Jojo, thank you.
Thank you so much.
After 6.5 weeks on strike, 40,000 Verizon employees will be back at work tomorrow. Hopefully my sister will now get her internet back. But what did the workers get? Unions representing the workers reached a tentative deal with Verizon late last week. It provides for 1,300 new call center jobs and 10% raises over 4 years. There will also be some changes to worker health care plans. Let's find out more from Cardiff Garcia, U.S. editor for FT Alphaville, the Financial Times blog. Hi, Cardiff.
Hey, Robin.
And this is one of the, we think, largest strikes in the country, at least in recent years. Each side claiming victory. Tell us more, though, about what each side wanted and what they got.
Yeah, this really was a kind of a throwback standoff where essentially the management of the company was fighting to hold down its costs and for the right to run the company a little bit more efficiently. And the unions were fighting to get a better deal for its workers, not just in terms of compensation, but also in terms of how they're treated. I hesitate to use the language of winning and losing for something like this because it lasted for a while and it was really quite tough. But I think it's true that the workers probably got more than what most observers were expecting them to get. So they got a higher raise. They got a better raise than what Verizon had originally proposed. They're going to get about 11% more. The accrued pension benefits seem to be protected from cuts that were also proposed. There was also this kind of relocation issue, which was a big deal to a lot of workers. Verizon had proposed being allowed to essentially relocate its workers for months at a time away from their homes. That has been withdrawn. So overall, a decent deal for workers. Verizon, in terms of what it can claim, well, you mentioned healthcare costs a second ago. They're going to be able to switch to a more affordable plan for them. The union will have to pick up some of the tab there. And also, there was this real sticking point about how when somebody called Verizon with a complaint or just for customer service, that the call had to be picked up in the same state as the call was being made. Now it can be sort of fielded anywhere in the Verizon network, which allows essentially Verizon to skip some steps and to run that part of its business a little bit more efficiently.
Well, the striking workers were mostly in Verizon's wireline business. This is landlines, internet services that run through a wire, as opposed to wireless companies. And that's been a lot of competition for Verizon, mobile phones, handheld devices. So what did Verizon get that helps it feel as if it can, you know, fight that competition?
Well, I mentioned a second ago that it would be able to hold down some of its costs into the future, right? Mm-hmm. But essentially, Verizon sees this part of its business as the past. The future, as you just mentioned a second ago, is in mobile. Verizon is also been essentially divesting a bunch of its wireline businesses for the last decade or so, really. And so some people think that this was essentially a first step towards Verizon eventually just selling off its entire wireline unit. That's all very speculative, and the only people who can really say for sure is the management. So I think Verizon saw this as something it needed to get past so that it can continue focusing on the future of its business, which it definitely sees as the mobile unit and not this wireline unit.
Well, we know many workers at the wireless divisions are mostly non-union. People think that might be the future, but I don't know. I'm looking at people who don't have retirement funds or pensions thinking, hey, wait a minute. You know, that union thing has some things to offer, so we'll keep to watching that. Cardiff Garcia, U.S. editor for the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks as always, Cardiff.
My pleasure, Robin.
When a big dairy or meatpacking company builds a factory in a Midwest city, it doesn't just bring in new jobs and industry. It changes the farms in the area, too. Luke Runyon of Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media explains.
Casey DeHaan's dairy farm near Ault in northern Colorado looks pretty standard from the county road it sits on. Big red barn, pen full of cows. But inside, those cows are filing onto a huge metal merry-go-round.
So this is they call this a rotary parlor. It's always moving, and the cows get on and off.
These dairy cows are being milked while the spinning machine inches along. The cows look down quizzically at us while DeHaan shows me around.
By the time the cow makes one revolution, she's completely done milking, and she goes back to the pen. And watch your head.
Duck under the machine as it continues to turn above us. DeHaan's been up and running here for 8 years after moving to Colorado from his home state of California. And lately, he's been growing his herd.
We went from 3,000 cows to 4,000 cows. You know, at that time, La Prina was wanting more milk as well, you know, so it worked out. And ultimately, we're shipping more milk down the road to the plant.
Catch that name? La Prina. It's a Denver-based mozzarella cheese manufacturer, the largest in the world. And the plant near DeHaan's dairy is just a few years old, takes in nearly all of the milk DeHaan's 4,000 cows churn out, plus much of the milk his neighboring dairy farmers produce. Mike Reedy is a La Prina executive.
There's a good chance if you go buy a bag of frozen mozzarella, shredded mozzarella in the grocery store, that it's our cheese.
La Prina's cheese is ubiquitous on everything from Papa John's pizza to frozen dinners. And to make it, they need a lot of milk. Already, their plant in Greeley, Colorado, uses millions of pounds of milk a day. Now it's about to expand. And to do that, the company will need a lot more cows nearby.
Generally, the number we've been sharing with folks is about an incremental 30,000 cows.
Since the late 90s, the number of dairy cows in northern Colorado has more than doubled. Tom Heron helped make that happen. He's the CEO of Ag Professionals, a consulting group in northern Colorado that helps farmers expand their operations or find locations for new farms.
Does it have the water? Does it have the land, regulatory environment, political will? The interest in the farmers and the people, does it have a market?
Heron says most new dairies here are popping up within an 80-mile radius of the expanding La Prina plant. Because milk can spoil quickly and shipping it in big refrigerated trucks is expensive, dairy farmers want their farms close to the companies who are buying their milk and the people in cities who drink it.
But we're also dealing in agriculture, and particularly with milk, with a perishable commodity. So how long can you sit on it before it becomes something that isn't usable?
In many ways, our food system is regional. You'll find big cattle feedlots near companies that produce hamburger meat and big hog farms near bacon factories. Farms cluster around the factories that process their products. Factories move closer to their suppliers. And the placement of a new factory can spur even more growth.
The trickle down on this is huge.
Changes to a region's agricultural makeup don't come without costs. The growing dairy region of Colorado is also seeing dramatic population growth. Water is limited. That's forcing new dairy farms to be more efficient with water and write big checks to buy the rights to use it. And many of the new and expanding dairies are finding themselves positioned near or within suburban communities. You can see some of those rapidly growing neighborhoods from Casey DeHaan's dairy farm. When he was designing his operation, he tried hard to cut down on odors from manure and muddy pens. He's looking to expand further to meet Leprino's thirst for milk.
8 million pounds of milk a day. They're knocking on the door now, wanting to get to that point. And so I think the Colorado dairymen and will do everything they can to help make that happen for them.
As they do, they'll be rewarded with a market ready for more. For Here and Now, I'm Luke Runyon.
And Luke's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues. Last night, Steph Curry led the Golden State Warriors in a 96-88 victory over the Oklahoma City Thunder, clinching a spot in the NBA Finals. They'll face the Cleveland Cavaliers, as they did last year in the final series, which starts on Thursday. Now, Curry sank three free throws and a three-pointer in the game's final moments. But in addition to some dazzling moves on the court, this year the NBA playoffs have also been showing off some fancy moves on the technology front. The league has teamed up with Intel to create 3D views of some replays, allowing broadcast outlets to freeze the video and rotate the view. Well, joining me now with more on this innovation and other applications of 3D video is John Carroll, Boston University professor of mass communication. John, good to see you.
Good to be here.
So, John, some of our listeners have undoubtedly seen these 3D replays. But for those who haven't, let's hear a little bit of Intel's promotional video on this. It starts out with a highlight clip of players dunking and sportscaster Marv Albert narrating.
In every game, there are moments worthy of another look.
Hit it!
From every angle in the house.
The player's frozen in midair. The video rotates 90 degrees and then another 90 degrees. You can see every angle. It's very much like playing basketball in the Matrix, I think. And then they roll the tape again, and he finishes the dunk.
Experience 360-degree replay from Intel. Yes!
Yes! John, how does it work?
Well, what they have is dozens of high-definition cameras all around the court, and they take the video of the action from all those different angles. Intel has the technological capability to stitch them all together and provide what they call a 3D viewing experience.
And that's the great thing, right, because they can stitch it all together very fast to make it a virtual instant replay.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
So where are people seeing these?
They see it in game broadcasts. They see it on NBA.com, the NBA app, and through social media. I should say that the NBA isn't the only one doing this. All kinds of sports teams have experimented with this kind of technology. Some of it's more sophisticated than others.
Okay, but the 3D approach obviously isn't just restricted to sports, although very exciting use there on basketball courts and baseball diamonds. How are news organizations, for example, using a virtual reality video and this 3D video in their digital platforms?
Yeah, I should say the 3D, 360, virtual reality, they're all kind of used interchangeably, but it's all catnip to media organizations. The New York Times is knee-deep in virtual reality. They've had a big commitment to it. They're pretty far ahead of a lot of other news organizations. They do everything from international reporting to arts and culture features. USA Today has launched a regularly scheduled news show called Virtually There. Washington Post has interactive virtual reality video and all kinds of broadcast outlets. ABC, CNN, Frontline, Hulu, all of them are jumping in here because what they want to do is provide something new, but also something immersive that that people will engage with, that will capture their attention.
Hmm. Well, tech companies are obviously jumping on the VR bandwagon. They kind of are the bandwagon, I'd say, right? Google, of course, has that cardboard VR viewer. Facebook purchased Oculus Rift, a very high-end virtual reality system. Who else is getting into the field?
Well, first, Facebook is also getting into 360-degree photos and 360-degree audio. So they're trying to get all the platforms, all the senses. PlayStation 4 is introducing a VR headset in October. It doesn't work all that well, I understand, with PlayStation 4 as it is. An upgrade probably is called for. There's some confusion over whether Apple's going to jump into this or not. Some say yes, some say no. One of the theories is that Apple will try to adapt some of its current technology to virtual reality.
Mm. Now, John, of course, with any new technology, which is, you know, it's probably going to become its own medium, right? This
right.
kind of VR or 3D experience, the money's going to follow. So what about advertising?
Advertisers are scrambling, desperately trying to figure out how to work their way into VR videos and also onto these platforms. I mean, advertisers are like death and taxes. If there's an audience, they're going to find them. So they're lagging behind a little bit, but they'll be there. There's no worry about that.
You can only imagine what it would be like to have like a virtual reality 3. I'm interchanging these. They're not totally right. interchangeable, but like a 3D experience of a car ad or something.
And travel companies and real estate companies and all kinds of businesses are looking at this as a way to promote their products in a whole different, much more vivid way.
Mm. Well, at least for now, we can see it on display on the basketball court. So it'll
for up to 7 more games anyway.
Exactly. It'll be great to see it. Well, John Carroll is a mass communication professor at Boston University. We've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at our website, hereandnow.org. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you were flying from Chicago's O'Hare Terminal 3, 7 a.m. Sunday morning, congratulations. You were in the weekend's longest security line at that airport. Atlanta's North Checkpoint froze up yesterday afternoon at 3:15, but otherwise a representative said lines averaged around 15 minutes on what's considered a dress rehearsal for summer. In fact, the Washington Post crunched the Memorial Day weekend numbers at security lines and found it wasn't as bad as some expected, but what about going forward? Next month, over 700 newly trained TSA agents will hit the airports, but still, how much time will we spend in those lines? And at what cost? Arnold Barnett is a professor of statistics at the MIT Sloan School of Management and an airline security expert. Professor, Americans spend an estimated 37 billion hours every year waiting in lines. Is there a way to put a dollar value on that at airports?
There is, although the calculations are a bit artificial. Economists try to put dollar prices on everything. The general figure that's used is 62 cents per minute, that if your air journey is elongated by a certain number of minutes, you multiply that by 62 cents to get the dollar equivalent of the pain you've suffered. For example, if people get to the airport a half an hour early because of anxieties related to the lengths of lines, that would work out to roughly $19 per person. If you assume there are 700 million American passengers per year, at that rate, I get something like $13 billion a year in these dollars that I consider fictitious.
Well, that's true. I mean, because it's not like you're actually paying out that money.
Exactly right. And if you have, let's say, the classic family of four, then in theory, 19 times four, it's about $75 associated with the wait. But if that family got to the airport and they said, well, if you give us $75, you won't have to wait, I don't think that many families would take that. And you have to remember, one of the reasons we have these very long lines now is that they did a test of TSA to see whether people could pick up mock weapons and mock explosives. And out of 70 tests, 67 failed. The failure rate was 95%.
And that's part of the reason that we have these long lines now. Other reasons, we know all the reasons that there were cutbacks, congressional budget cuts, and so 12% of the TSA workforce was cut. But also that people themselves slow the line down. Last week alone, the TSA says it confiscated 74 firearms, 65 of them loaded, 3 with bullets in the chambers, from carry-ons across the country. That was the most ever in a single week. And we hear when a gun is found, it can slow right there because they have to call the police. That's 25 minutes right there. So there's a lot of different factors here.
That's true, but I think we have to think about what if they didn't slow up the line? What if TSA were to say after a 95% failure rate on the test that, well, to keep things moving, we can't do anything about that. I mean, what would be the price of the anxiety people would feel if they knew that the TSA screening were highly ineffective? I mean, I understand how the frustration, and certainly you're right, TSA is not blameless for many of the things or those who have funded TSA. But I think for this summer, where it might be difficult to remedy things immediately, maybe we should just accept it. A little penalty we have to pay for the war on terror rather than something much worse.
What about the impact on the airlines? One airline told the Washington Post that it delayed 37 flights from one airport in one day over the past weekend. Another said security delays caused 70,000 passengers and 40 checked bags to miss flights. What's the impact there? I mean, that I would think would be sizable if you have to refund those tickets or find those bags.
I would agree. And ideally, the arrangements will become more efficient, as has seemed to have happened over the Memorial Day weekend, so that these stories become outliers rather than the norm. However, if the airlines need reminding, what is the price of successful terrorism? You know, I just read that in Egypt, for example, after the bombing last November of the plane leaving the resort area, tourism is down 45% for the first 3 months of this year. And the airlines themselves, after 9/11, suffered gargantuan losses in passengers and revenue for a very long time. So, yes, of course there are costs associated with the present procedure, but the costs that we're trying to avert with those measures are enormously greater.
Yeah. And staying with statistics, people overestimate how long they've waited in line by about 36%. If you tell them it's a half an hour, they say, no, no, it was 40 minutes and longer. But as we've been hearing, there are things that people still do that help gum up those lines.
There's no doubt that that happens. Of course, there are certain things that can remedy that problem you mentioned. For example, if you make sure that clocks are conspicuous near the security checkpoints, then people will have a better sense of how much they actually waited. If I see a big clock with red digital letters that says I started at 3:15 and I got through security at 3:28, then I'm not going to go and say I waited 45 minutes.
Yeah, well, and it might make you feel a little bit better. Arnold Barnett, professor of statistics at the MIT Sloan School of Management, also an airline security expert. Professor Barnett, thank you so much.
And thank you so much.
Although, Megan, I don't know, we won't be able to complain if there's a clock there. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.